Welcome, everyone, to the One City, One Story discussion. My name's Katie Murphy. I've been the One City, One Story project manager for about the past 9 months, so it's been a great process. I've really enjoyed it. I am here to remind you to turn off your cell phones, because we do want to have a great discussion where we can hear everyone and it's not interrupted. And after, following the event, Mr. Russo will sign books outside if you go up the stairs, and it will be right outside. And one strange announcement, that there will be an alarm at 4:45, but do not be alarmed. The library is closing. It closes at 5. It's just a sign of that. The book signing will still go on. So, you know, shake, and then we'll go on. And I am going to turn this over to Alicia instead.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you to Debbie Porter at the Boston Book Festival for this just amazing opportunity to take some time to dive in a little bit more deeply to a work of art written by one of the great novelists, screenwriters, short story writers of our time. Rick Russo is here with us today. Richard Russo and his wife Barbara are here, but we're not going to let them talk for a little while, because really this is a discussion among those of us in the city of Boston who love to read and who love to think and share about language and with our own language, the short story, The Whore's Child. As way of kind of starting our conversation, I want to tell you that for me reading this story, it was a return to my Catholic roots, and maybe some of you feel that way too. Boston's the most Catholic place I've ever lived, and I've lived around the country, and it's extraordinary to live in a city that embraces and struggles with its Catholicism, as I think this story does. I related so much to the kind of fear of telling a nun something about her story, the kind of fear of seeming sinful in front of a nun, or even depicting a nun as a human being, which I was born post-Vatican II, but I still had severe reverence for priests and nuns, and I'm sure many of you can relate to that. What I'd like to ask you, though, is when you read this story, what did you relate to as you were reading it? Was there a character who stood out to you that resembled someone or seemed familiar to you from your own life? Was there a moment in it that you recognized either as a writer yourself or as a Catholic or as a teacher? Would anyone like to tell us what your entry point was? And we also have mic runners in the room, so if you just raise your hand, someone would be delighted to put a mic in your face. And that's what our discussion is about. Anyone want to tell us what your entry point is? Okay, thank you.
Well, there's so much. But there's a phrase I love when she attends the class, and the students all around are saying, Sister Ursula's first installment ended here, and her fellow students approach the discussion of it as one would an alien spacecraft. And I don't know how many of you are returning students at a certain age, maybe a middle age, and are surrounded by youngsters. I never thought I'd be in this position, but I am in this position. And it just resonated very strongly to feel a little bit like that alien in a class that I'm taking, frankly. And I've been in this situation again when everyone's 20 years old or younger. And here I am in my 50s. But the whole experience, the sense of being somewhat estranged in any case, or strange, or different, is certainly, I think, that everyone can at one time or another relate to. I just happen to be relating to it again, besides adolescence.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew, for your comment. I want to ask you, too, you're talking about this outsider status that you're relating to in this story, the outsider status of the nun. And yet, it seems to me, the nun herself doesn't really think of herself as an outsider. When she comes into the classroom, she sits right down in the middle of everything. She's completely ready to jump in and discuss her work and be a part of that. Do you think that you could learn something from Sister Ursula?
How to be a Catholic? No. It's I'm not so sure what her, it's true that she is so, she's so out of it that she's not aware that she's out of it. And
okay.
If I could learn something about that, maybe there's something to be said for ignorance being bliss, but I don't know how you can teach ignorance.
Right, okay.
Although maybe I've had many ignorant teachers in my life.
right. Okay, thank you very much. Did anyone else, how many of you actually read the story? Let's just get a show of hands. That is awesome. Is it? How many of you got this story because somebody was standing on a street corner handing it out? Okay, slightly less awesome, but but good. Wouldn't it be a great America if on the street corners people were just handing out short stories like this? Here's Richard Russo's story. Have a good day. Wouldn't that be great? Did anyone relate to the teacher? Did anyone have some sense that he? Okay, sir, we're going to get you a microphone, sir, right here. Well, I think we're recording, so I think we'd love to have your voice amplified. Thank you.
How I related to the narrator was his passivity. And it's interesting that the first person who made a comment talked about the nun as the outsider. I actually perceived the narrator as the outsider. He lets her sit in the class even though he shouldn't. He doesn't tell her a story about himself when he could have. In some ways, he was the outsider and the non-person, as opposed to the nun. That was my take on it, and I enjoyed his passivity. So.
So what we know about him is he's had a struggle in his marriage. He's been unfaithful to his wife. He's living alone.
Do we know that?
Pardon me?
I mean, I know it says that.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing with you. We do learn some things about him.
Yes, we do.
In the course of the story. So there's a kind of parallel.
None of which he shares with her.
Right.
None of which he shares. None of which he shares with anybody.
Right.
It's his interior dialogue.
Right.
And there's, I like interior dialogue, but in terms of interfacing with the external world, I thought he presents as a very passive person.
I agree with you, and I think also that she is a foil to that in that she has no interior dialogue. It's all out there.
Right.
It's all out there. Right, thank you. Someone else want to tell us about a character you related to or a situation? There were a couple more hands. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I didn't identify with Sister Ursula as one who's been beaten by nuns. I understand her, what's the word? It's not hatred, but...
Oh, I think it is.
Well... Okay, it is. And I just admire the way she moved in that world that she didn't really know, but it didn't matter to her. She needed to tell her story. So I admired her a lot.
What did you think about her struggle with her story at the end? I mean, there seems to be a revelation handed to her through her process of writing. You know, I've taught writing for more than 20 years, and I'm always saying, there's discovery in writing. But until you really sit down and start plumbing the depths the way that she does, the discovery may not come. What did you think of her discovery, just about herself, not necessarily about paternity, but about herself in that moment?
Oh, that she was so surprised that she didn't... It never occurred to her. But, you know, that's the way human beings are.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Did you relate to that moment?
Yes, I think that's a universal trait, universal human trait. You just don't see something if it's too close.
Interesting, yes, I agree with you. Others who, down here, sir, and then we'll come over to this side. Right here, okay. Thank you.
I didn't relate to the characters. I the first thing I thought of when I started the story was Henry James is the real thing. And I thought that Sister, when she sat down in the classroom and just was like an immovable force, it was because she had lived a life of integrity, even, and she, it wasn't the thing you would think a nun would do. She hated, she would pray that these people would be punished, or her fellow nuns, and so forth. And finally, there's the fire at the end, that great scene at the end. But the contrast between that and a professor who didn't have integrity in his marriage and students who were talking from, criticizing the story from these little theories. They had these little theories in their head. They were like insubstantial people compared to her, and that made her the center. And yet at the center of her, she had this unreality. So the question of what's real and so forth, it was so well explored.
Well, there's also that, is the author telling her biography, or is it a memoir? Is it she's in a fiction class and she's writing memoir, and she just doesn't even, doesn't care that it's a fiction class, right? So there's that tension
She doesn't care that she should have taken two previous classes. She's just there. And she stood up for herself in a way, which might have been the only time she did in her life. She committed herself to being a nun, was persecuted all the time, and thought that Jesus would approve of her hatred or punishment of these others, putting on the cross.
Because he gave her a beautiful heart, and he must have put that in there, right?
But she stuck with her guns all her life, and sticking with her guns still didn't reveal the truth to her till she goes to this unexpected place. Earlier she had gone around America looking, she ran out of money, looking for her dad, who wasn't her dad. And at the end, she gets to the point where she kind of is complacent about what the students think the dad is really the pimp. And I don't know if she accepted it, but she realized that she had no idea. And then she goes back to being the nun in the last three pages, and the professor goes back to almost apologizing to her. He wants to apologize to her in some way. And she then, the last lines where the flames almost reach heaven, mm-hmm. and that's the spirit. So it's such a Catholic image. Right. It's a wonderful way to close the story. And
it's a lovely moment, too, where he feels compelled to almost have confessions.
Yes,
with her
exactly.
In that moment.
That's what I meant by apologize. Exactly.
Yes, right. How would you describe her, just quickly, if someone said, what's Sister Ursula like? What would you say?
She was real.
For real. Okay. Anyone else, how would you describe Sister Ursula? Do you want to come?
You said she was everything was out there with her. I had kind of like the opposite. She's living in a convent with elderly nuns. She seems to be like the youngest one there. So she's seeing age and end of life almost on a daily basis. So my feeling is that this is a story that's been bubbling up inside her for a very long time. And she's afraid to have her whole life go by without her sharing it or expressing it in some way. And I don't think that, to me it was never clear that she knew she was telling, I think she knew she was in a fiction class and she wanted this to be fiction. And the interesting thing to me is even though she probably came to class in a habit, the other students didn't really think that it was about her because they were talking about the character. And it seemed like only the teacher knew that it was her. And I think she thought she fooled them into thinking that it was a character. And that was the only way she could do it and still be safe.
Right. Well, of course, as the gentleman said before you, they had been taught all these tricks of the trade. So it was almost inconceivable for them to think that this was a true story, except occasionally someone in the class would be so deeply affected by it to just say, you know, I like it. You know, it's a good story, which, of course, is what it all comes back to in the end. Anyway, did you like Sister Ursula?
I've known some Sister Ursula types in my education, and my first reaction was not to like her. But then when you start thinking of them as having lives mm-hmm. before you knew them, it kind of something I never thought about when I had a Catholic education.
Right. I think the story does humanize her for us. Whether you like her or don't like her almost is irrelevant in a way. It's that you see something of her real soul in her moments. Other comments? Okay, go ahead.
As someone completely disconnected with either the Catholic faith or Christianity, I approach the story, obviously, with that clinical detachment. But the part of Sister Ursula's life that I most appealed to me was in the middle section when the hatred and the dissension comes in, and how she is able to, you know, break free from that stoic, typically stoic role of the nun to sort of form her own judgment. And I love the way how she condones the malice of her own prayers and at the same time says, well, they will never come true. I think that maverick part that she took was really, for me, the most delightful part, because it represented a real, you know, deviation, as it were, from the typical role of the repressed, suffering, you know, married to Christ woman.
Right. So remember that we have a little window on that very early in her life with the shoes, where she's made to wear the shoes that don't fit her. And she says, wait, these shoes don't fit me. Could I switch them off with the kid whose shoes are too big? And, you know, so, and she's not a nun yet, even though, I mean, so we have some sense of her in her real humanity before she becomes a nun. She doesn't really become a nun because she has a calling, does she?
Right.
You know, so it's almost as if she has no choice there, which brings up an interesting point. What choices does she have in her life? She's labeled early on as the whore's son, the whore's child, and, you know, never really gets out of that way of thinking in her life. Did you struggle with that at all? You said you didn't really think of it as Catholic or these other categories around it, but what about that formative moment when you're called something and right. It becomes then who you are?
Well, even when she's called that and you know, the judgment is passed, I like the way how she still believed in her father and thought that it was unfair that she should just be cast aside. So I think she was really forming her own values per se. She played along with it because her options were very limited. But I saw her as a very independent woman, you know, within this scaffold of repression. So, but that one part where she just, you know, says that I can pray whatever I like is what I really enjoyed the most in the story.
That's a great comment, and I love the part at the end too, where she asks the teacher, you know, do you like women? And he says, I do. And she says, well, I like men. You know, and so you get this sense of, oh, maybe there's other stuff going on inside of Sister Ursula all these years, right? Let's talk a little bit about the father, because of course there are a lot of levels to father in this story. You know, there's the missing father, there's the father with the capital F. You know, and how important it was for her to connect with her father, the father, the father, the father. This is the mantra of the Catholic Church, of course, the Heavenly Father. Anyone have any insight into the father images? There was someone over here who raised his hand.
I think of Sister Ursula as a tragic figure who was caught up in a situation where she suffered tremendously outside of her control. And what got her through was a fantasy of being loved and being rescued, either by her biological father or by her heavenly father. And in the end, it seemed like both fathers really didn't come through for her. And I thought one of the saddest things was when she realized that she would become one of the sisters. And in fact, with her anger and her bitterness and resentment, she had become one of the sisters. And even though I think we can understand her and have compassion for her, because we know what she's been through and how she got there, just as with the teacher, we can understand why he messed up his marriage and it wasn't a good thing, but he's a poor, suffering human being and so is she, and probably so are the other sisters. So I think in the end it was a story that aroused a lot of compassion, but a lot of sadness as well.
I think it's written with a lot of compassion, too, for these characters. Let's run down here. I don't know where the closest mic. Oh, I'm sorry. Was there someone up there, too? Katie? Okay. Come on down, Katie. Thank you.
So I think my diving board into the story, and it's also the same way that I think for me, the main theme or question of the story arises, which is, where is the father? And both literally her father, but also, is there a God? So is there a God is kind of the question that comes out of the short story for me. And I'm a 25-year-old woman, but I relate most to your first question with the narrator and the professor. And in the moment when he goes, he felt cheated. And then how human and poetic and beautiful that he to kind of resolve that feeling cheated would actually cheat then in real life and do it in a way knowing that he wasn't getting any satisfaction from it and kind of living, it's a kind of a weird state to be, a state of tension, and that he then is also a professor. So it's kind of this cynicism and optimism at the same time, somebody who's broken can at the same time teach others to what be fulfilled or to be whole. And the wonderful structural thing of the marginalia, so every having a comment, the very first line always, right? And kind of the irony of being able to be, I guess, both bold enough and beautiful enough to have comment to someone's life, but also be almost arrogant enough to take that role on. And the idea, the structural element of a frame of someone's life. So having all of these words on the page that are her life, and that there's meaning behind it, that there's structure behind it, and that in essence is also would be the structure of having, like, there is meaning in our lives, and there's a God or a something other out there in the white space of our life. So,
as you were moving through the story, what was your sense of the father from the beginning? Were you thinking, gee, I wonder if he's coming back? What point did you have a revelation about the father?
So I use the word diving board. So there's this undercurrent for me, like the story has a lot of water in it, even though I don't think water is written anywhere in the story. And it's a tugging feeling that you get through the first sentence all the way to the very last sentence, which is the search for the father. And almost the disbelief and the punch you get in the gut when you read the line about it being a pimp, and hadn't occurred to me, but of course that seems so delicately obvious and perfect.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Did anyone see it coming? Did anyone see the pimp line coming? Oh, right. Would you like to say something? No, don't want to talk about it. Anyone else? I mean, were you surprised by that? Did it surprise you? Okay, up top, Katie, and you just have to call out to me if there's someone up there, please, that I can't quite see. Okay, please.
I was surprised at the end, and I was very intrigued by the whole framework narrative, and like the other gentleman said, I too was thinking about Henry James, but I was thinking about Turn of the Screw and more how a story can, I almost felt like her story was given to her or forced on her by this, you know, the students being kind of a character unto themselves as opposed to being individuals, and telling her what her story was, so that by the end, I was feeling a little Henry James-ish, like, well, did he really, is that true? Really, can I buy that? And I still, you know, have a question about it. I'd love to hear an answer about it.
Okay. I just want to, if you could hold the mic for just a second, I want to ask you about when you're reading a story like this, did you read it more than once, or did you read it just once?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And when you're in the process of reading, do you find yourself stopping and reflecting, or is it afterward when you're, I don't know, going for a walk or, you know, over dinner or something that something hits you? When does the moment of the story happen for you, or when did it with this one?
Right, and I can't say that every single story I read I stop and reflect as I go along, but this story invited me to do that, and again, it was because of that whole framework narrative where, you know, you're being told a story within a story, and so it does kind of invite you to stop and reflect as you go along, and you get different segments of it and different pieces of information mm-hmm. kind of come flying by.
Well, even visually, there's some error around the segments in
yes.
the white space, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right. I don't know if that's on purpose or not. someone else want to jump in? Okay, over here, please.
Oh, okay, I'm not at all convinced that the father is a pimp. Just okay. I have to throw that out there. Just like the story leads a certain way, it may be leading us to that assumption, but I'm not sure that it's the truth. Maybe the students are putting the story where they want it to be. I'm not convinced.
Right, so does there have to be a truth to that?
Do we have to know? No, there doesn't, absolutely, but I think I hear a lot of people sort of leaning in that direction, and I think it's so open that that's not necessarily a conclusion that can be drawn from the story.
Well, of course, all of the students in the class are also saying, hey, we need to know this, we need to know this, and maybe the truth is
unimportant.
We don't need to know this.
Right.
Did anyone else feel that way? Yeah. Anyone else want to say something about that? Thank you. Thank you for your comment.
I can't remember when it was in the book that I realized that this person that she was talking about might have been a pimp, was a pimp. I only got a chance to read it late last night, so I haven't read it twice. But somewhere along the way, it dawned on me, well, you know, this man that she's talking about is probably a pimp. And then, similar to that woman over there, I don't necessarily believe that that pimp was her father. And it's the same question to me as, you know, who is the father? It's, you know, there's got to be a father, but what about God, God the Father? I mean, that's another ambiguous thing for a lot of people. So I thought it was very interesting in that regard.
And in my reading of it today, which I you know, I've read it several times too, but I went back and read it again today, I was thinking as I was reading through, I'm not convinced that this guy who's dropped her off here is her father. You know, is
right.
You know, is that? And you know, it's an interesting reflection too, because by the way, who is Jesus' father? That's a confusing one too, right? I mean, it's never really clear. I mean, if you're a person of faith, it's clear to you. You know, but even St. Joseph wasn't really the father in the way that we understand fatherhood, right? So, I mean, there's some really interesting echoes about fatherhood in this story. Go ahead, you were going to respond again.
No, I have nothing more to say.
Yeah, it's a very interesting set of circumstances. We have a comment down here. Thank you, ma'am, for your comments. Katie, you're getting your work out today.
Well, there seems to be a third father story in here. The narrator's a father.
Right.
This woman is desperately telling the story of loss, and we understand what happened to the mother and daughter, but we don't have any explicit discussion of whether he's trying to be a figure in his daughter's life. So that's sort of an interesting thing going on while all this pain's being expressed by another person.
Right, so all these Trinity families happening here, right? Mother, father, child. Anyone else want to jump in that? Okay, great, thank you.
I just wanted to say that in the moment when we first hear that the father may be the pimp, for me what struck me was that all the students didn't get it. It was one student who was very quiet during the whole process of this, and all of a sudden, in the moment she's going to say this, it's very specific that her eyes were brimming with tears. So this young woman, I think, understands that what she's about to say may be a revelation for Ursula. And through the professor saying, you know, sending her this urgent telepathic message, like, please don't say it, like, we can't have Ursula learn this. And all the other students are surprised. So I don't feel like all the students did put this on her. I think it was one young woman who had a little bit more introspection and was able to share that. To me, it didn't matter so much whose Ursula's father was. To me, it was more that she went into this process to figure some things out for herself. And I think she was willing to do that by putting the tiny little margins and the smaller type and trying to get more and more words onto those pages because she desperately wanted to figure out what her truth might be and was led down that road by this one young woman willing to put it out there. So I just thought that was really interesting. And I don't mind whether it is or isn't true that her father was the pimp. It was more the idea of what do we do when we search for truth and we're not sure we want the answers. And then we find out something and we have to deal with that.
That's a great point. I mean, the teacher says to her straight off, we're all liars here in this room. We come here to lie. And she says, I've been doing that forever. You know, and it's almost as if she says, I've been doing that forever. I'm on to the next thing now. I'm going to tell the truth. Right, so it's an interesting place to be. Go ahead, Katie. Thank you for your comment.
I'm struck by the juxtaposition between the horrendous life she has with the nuns and the magical moment with the, quote, father, end quote, in which took her to the wharf to see the boats, to a small carnival where a man her father knew let her ride a pony. The image that there's this pimp prostitute world, and I can imagine this reasonably courtly pimp who strikes you as a father figure, who while mother is making her money has to take care of this little girl and does it in a fatherly way. And one imagines a certain amount of rich life there, the mother and the deathbed, the idea that the mother in some way reached out to the child, or just the imagining that she wanted to share this moment. There's a family here, and it's a totally different family than a traditional family, but was richer in many ways, even though brief in Sister Ursula's life than the life she led in the true religion, that one wishes, even though, again, what the mother did for a living we may not condone, and yet there's her family, and she missed out the chance for it, and maybe just as she writes the story realizes how rich it was, although minimal.
She's in a moment of prejudgment, right? I mean, she just accepts that she goes on this cart with her father from place to place, and that he goes in, and it's dark, and there are lots of men coming and going to those buildings, and that her mother does what she does. She doesn't particularly like the way her perfume smells, but she doesn't make any judgment on anyone at that moment in her life. Other comments along these lines? So, Richard Russo, you've said that you start off with a problem you don't know the solution to in your writing. Please join me. Please welcome Richard Russo.
Thank you. Wonderful job. Are we going to sit down?
No, we're going to stay out here in the audience.
Good.
Richard, tell us what the problem was that you found in the story. What was the problem you felt you needed to solve here?
First of all, I have to say thank you to all of you. I have learned so much. this really has been a wonderful experience. The first story that I wrote when I was in graduate school came out, and I still can remember the devastation to this day of seeing that story when it came out, because I had submitted to a magazine I had never read, never even seen. And when the story was published, it came back. I was imagining something like Bound, and this was Stapled. That was my first published story too. One of the things that writers almost never see is for a story or a book to land. You know, we work in the dark, and we spend a fair amount of time writing these things. But except for that rare occasion, well, it happens more often if you're Stephen King, but that rare occasion when you happen to be sitting on a plane and two rows up, somebody is reading a book of yours, that's as close as you come to seeing what anything that you've done land. And sitting here today has been both emotional and very humbling to listen to all of you pay such deep respect to something and to just see it land, just see my beloved Sister Ursula as someone that you people care about. That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. To Alicia's question, one of the things, unfortunately, about a story or a book when it's finished and someone asks you how it began, where it came from, it's difficult, because what happens is, I'm sure there was exactly that kind of problem there that I was trying to solve, and I might take a couple of guesses, but what happens to me as a writer anyway is that once I solve the problem or bring it to the point where it can't be solved and is open-ended in some sort of satisfying way, I then forget what the artistic problems were, because I've solved them, and at the moment, I'm working on something else where the problems are real and right in front of me, and kind of all-consuming. So whatever my problems were 7 years ago when I wrote this story, I'd forgotten those, you know. Before the story was published, I'd forgotten what those problems were, but I'm sure that they were there. I know that I was living. No, I wasn't. I wasn't living in New Haven at the time, but the story goes back to New Haven when I was teaching at the university there. But also, I lived not far from a group of elderly nuns who had been in this very old, decrepit house, and it seemed to me that they had just all been abandoned there. And I would see that there this car go by. And
was it really a station
wagon? It was a Woody. the station wagon would go by with all the nuns in it, one grim nun at the wheel. I was thinking at the time about the way priests are treated, retired elderly priests are treated in the Catholic Church, as opposed to the way nuns are treated. And look into it sometime. Don't take my word for it. I think I just saw these nuns driving by every day. I was teaching a class there at that time. I was the only teacher there who used to like to teach the night classes, and I used to like them because I get a weird assortment of students in there, a lot of them older, a lot of them coming from day jobs, and they weren't all 20 years old. I did have a couple of nuns from time to time, and there were nuns around the building, the ones that I knew just struck me as very lonely, and some of them had lived very hard lives, and now they had so little to show for it. And so I think that car, and just trying, and also I have to admit there's a kind of chutzpah involved when a writer at the age that I was, the gender that I am, gets to write a story about an octogenarian Belgian nun. And you think people asking you, what the hell do you know about octogenarian Belgian nuns? And you think, well, that's as good a reason as any.
let's actually stop there for a second and ask you that question, because how can you, Richard, know about an octogenarian Belgian nun? I mean, how do you get inside her head? What happens?
Well, I don't know anything about octogenarian Belgian nuns. My anchors to this story, and everybody always asks me, are you the writer in that story? Nobody ever asks me, are you the nun? But in fact, my real ties, my real emotional ties to this story are all to Sister Ursula. And when I went looking for things for Sister Ursula, and I found all sorts of things, but when I went looking for Sister Ursula's life, I found them, things, not surprisingly, in my own life. One year, when I was working road construction with my father, I had come back home and had bought a pair of work shoes, and they were still stiff, and I went to work in them that day. By the end of the day, I was walking around in blood-soaked socks, and the next, for days after that, I was limping. Everybody was laughing at me, making fun of me. But I walked around in my for about the next 2 weeks. Nothing about me, the way I carried myself in the world, was the same. Simply because I was walking around with feet that they were just so sore that it was beyond painful. And so, a lot of what fiction writers do, I think, is we make these weird connections. Now, why in the world should a male, I don't know what age I was at the time I wrote this, I'm 62 now, so I was probably around 50. Why would a 50-year-old writer/English professor remember one summer when I was limping around in blood-soaked shoes, and why should that help me write a story about about an octogenarian Belgian nun? But it has something to do with pain. It has something to do with loss. We've all had pain. We all have loss. We've all suffered longing. My parents separated when I was fairly young. My father was in and out of my life, and I always remember the longing of that. And the great thing about fiction is, I think that we get, as a result of those things that we share, we get to transcend all the things that we don't share. I'm never going to be a woman. I'm never going to be a nun. I don't know if I'm ever going to get to be an octogenarian, but I just feel an enormous wealth, really, of shared experience between myself and Sister Ursula.
When you talk about that, let's just go back to your shoes and the job you were doing with your father. When you talk about repurposing that for fiction, is it something conscious? I mean, did you think to yourself, let's say you're 50 when you write the story, so maybe at 48 you thought, you know, someday I'm going to write about those shoes. And did, or does it just come forth?
Just, for me, it just comes forth. I had a very good writing teacher who told me never to keep a journal, which is the exact opposite of what a lot of writing teachers tell their students. And he said, if you keep a journal, you're always going to be consulting it. And if you're always consulting it, you're never going to allow that part of your brain where the truest stories are going to come from, the subconscious. You're never going to allow your subconscious to weigh in. And I believed in that and acted upon that that advice for most of my writing life until fairly recently, when my memory has just gotten so bad that if I don't take at least a few notes on what might be decent story ideas, I've discovered that I'm capable of forgetting just about anything, and subconscious, conscious, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter to me. If I don't make a note of it, it's gone. but I think that there was a lot of wisdom in that, in not making, or certainly not making too many notes, on the theory that when you really need something for a story, you will find it, or it will find you. Whichever of those.
Whether you know it or not, right?
Whether you know it or not.
We were talking about that in the green room, about whether or not the imagery is always purposeful or whether it comes through you because you're an artist, you know, and you're you mitigate all of that and facilitate that, and whether you know it's there or not.
Right.
You'd like to believe you've controlled it all, maybe.
I think one of the great misconceptions about people who don't write have about writers is that they think we're smart and that we plan things. they plan things out. I don't think writers, at least not this writer, I can tell you from personal experience, this writer is smart enough to plan out even a short story, much less a novel, at least in all of its intricacy. What we do have to be smart enough to do, though, is recognize something when we've done it. If you write a story that's as deeply enmeshed in Catholicism, and my own, I was raised Catholic too, surprise, surprise. When you write a story like this, I wouldn't dream of sitting down and trying to figure out how this image is going to play against that image and where it's going to go and all of that. But you do have to be smart enough that when you do something and you realize how many times the word father is in a story, and it's in a religious story, and then you have to think to yourself, oh, wait a second, maybe there's something here. And it's in that enormous, after the story is written, after you know how the story ends, it's only afterwards that you go through and you turn all the ducks so that they're facing the same direction, because they weren't in the early drafts, and you get your job, your final job as an artist is to make it look like you knew what you were doing from the beginning.
Okay, let's open up the floor. Do you have questions for Richard Russo about the story? Anyone would like to start us off with? Okay, right here, please. We're gonna get a mic to you. I'm sorry.
I have a very practical question.
Hang on just a second. There we go.
I have a very pedestrian practical question. When you were a teacher, if somebody came to your class and hadn't paid tuition and didn't have the prerequisites, would you allow them into the class?
No.
Well, I didn't have the willing suspension of disbelief to get past that. I mean, I finally did.
No, I was when I was teaching at the university, I was a lot like the character in this story, in that I learned very early on that if students came in whose names were not on the roll, that the longer you allowed them to stay there, the greater their belief was going to be that they would be able to wheedle or cajole their way into your class. So I usually showed them the door right away, and unless they had a story I hadn't heard before, and which could remotely be true. But they're
Richard,
worse.
I should just interrupt you quickly to alert everyone that within about 2 minutes there's going to be a bell ringing.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
just
yeah.
sorry to interrupt.
It's all right. I would find, however, that football players were an awful lot easier to throw out than people outweighed me by 200 pounds. I would show the door immediately to. But I could just imagine that Sister Ursula would be the one person that this guy who's been throwing people out of his classes for the last 20 years would never be able to find a way to throw her out.
And then when she came to your house at 7:30 in the morning, you had another chance to say no thank you.
That blessedly has not happened to me.
But listen to the interesting language this woman has just used.
I heard it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the assumption. Let's talk about that, because it's so tempting when you're dealing with a writer to think, oh, of course this is something about Richard Russo. This is Richard Russo. Why do we think that way?
Well, I mean, sometimes writers don't do an awful lot to discourage it, do they? I did put this in a point of view. I made the character roughly my age. I made him a writer, which I am. I made him a university professor, which I was. Mm-hmm. I could have done all of that differently if I was particularly interested in making sure that you didn't think that there was any connection between that character and me. And I chose not to do that. Again, I'm not exactly sure why. It just seemed to me to be a shortcut into the story rather than create an entire job or profession that I myself didn't know anything about and would have to research. It just seemed easier for me to enter the world through a portal that I knew very well, because I knew that the story was really about Sister Ursula anyway. And this guy is there, I think, in the story mostly for counterpoint. Mostly because, despite the fact that he himself is a storyteller, he shares with Sister Ursula so much less than she has shared with him. And because he knows professionally how to write stories and would never make the kinds of mistakes in storytelling that Sister Ursula does. Nevertheless, he also may never have told a truer story in his life than this elderly nun has just told him, with the most astonishing generosity, because I think she is fundamentally a much more generous person than he is.
And he feels so guilty. He's living in guilt right now. Yes, right. Yeah. Other questions for Richard Russo? Okay, up here.
Why did you choose the frame of a class? And the story is about Sister Ursula. I can imagine a lot of other surrounds that would bring out the same points or maybe different points and avoid some of the complexity of this story.
Yeah. Why choose a writing class? The short philosophical and fairly simple reason is, I think that this is also a story about stories. It's the stories that we tell ourselves and manage to tell ourselves throughout our lives, sometimes with a key missing ingredient, so that in some way we all don't ever know the story of our lives. And I thought of this as right as the beginning of Sister Ursula struggling to tell a story that she herself didn't understand. So putting her in a classroom with other students who could ask these sometimes ridiculous questions of her, which would make her scratch her head and go back and dig deeper, just seemed kind of a natural to me. The other reason is a little bit more technical and a little bit actually more fun, is that I don't know how many of you are writers in here, but if you are, and if you've been writing stories for a while, you know that there's this kind of magical principle called the rule of threes. Screenplays have three acts, basically. A lot of stories fall into what we typically think of as three-act structure. And the idea is you tell something the first time. The second time you tell the same thing, but the second time the ante is upped a little bit more, right? There's a little bit. There are a few more coins in the center of the pot, and so this. So in Act One you say something. In Act Two you say it again, only now it seems to weigh more because other things have intervened. Then you say it the third time in the third act, and the third time is the payoff. That's the magic, is the third time. Well, the interesting thing about teaching creative writing is that there are a series of these three-act structures that you go through with a student with every story, or that I did, anyway, is that you read the story, but the story, as you go through in with Sister Ursula, every time the students read the story, and then the student comes in for an individual conference with the teacher. Right, now, wait a second. What's the third one now? I've forgotten.
The hand in the paper.
Oh, and the comments on the paper.
Right.
So you get the story, the comments from the students, and then the individual conference afterwards. So I got to play with the rule of threes three times. Right. Those are almost magic numbers for a fiction writer. So you get three different sets of payoffs at least.
Do they teach you that in how to be a professor school, where you tell them what you're going to tell them what you told them?
That's right.
How many of you are writers? How many of you are writers in your professional life or in your dream life? Yeah. Okay. Other questions right down here. And Katie, I can't see beyond where you were, so you'll have to let me know.
I'm curious to know if the religious views expressed in this book, in this story, reflect your own thoughts in any way, Vatican II or pre-Vatican II. You wish to comment on it?
Sure. This story, I think that this story reflects not so much my thoughts as a former Catholic, recovering Catholic.
As if.
as if. This story has nothing to do with my thoughts, my ideas, my conclusions. It has to do with my questions. And those of you who have been going to other sessions today, as I have been, have probably heard more than once that a storyteller's job is probably not to provide answers, but to frame the question sufficiently that we can all explore towards something which there may, the deepest and most important questions probably don't have answers. So Sister Ursula's longing for and waiting for the father who's not going to show up. And the way that she relates that to her faith, she sees her father, she equates the father whom she imagines is going to ride up and rescue her on a horse. She equates him with Jesus on the cross. And the one father is not going to show up. Is the other father? I wouldn't presume to know the answer to that question, but I know the question. So that's if I can frame the question correctly, truthfully, I'll trust all of you to come up with the answers.
Go ahead, Katie, just right here.
Dovetailing that, how often do your stories and characters take turns you don't like, and do you have to ever write things that are hard for you to write?
It happens fairly frequently. I have been known to follow characters into places that I would have preferred not to follow them. I think Lucy Lynch in Bridge of Sighs is an example of a character that I fell in love with, but who took me to a darker place than I ever want to go again, when he, in midway through that book, crosses his own personal bridge of sighs and sees his father on the bridge, and realizes, some part of him realizes that he doesn't want to go back over. He doesn't want to cross back over into life. That was a more, because I cared for him and understood him, That was his moment of despair was something that in order to write truthfully, I had to kind of share. And I'm an optimistic guy. I'm very cautious in my optimism, but I am a fairly optimistic guy. Was very difficult for me to follow Lucy Lynch to that place of despair and desperation. So that's just one example, but it does happen with me frequently that a character will do or say something that I find profoundly disturbing, and I'll be faced with the choice of do I follow him or her there or just say no, this would be counter to my health. Mental and other.
Is it disturbing because of its content unto itself, or disturbing because it lives inside of you somewhere?
Yes to both.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. We have a question up here. We have time for about two more questions.
Okay. I was intrigued by the way your 17-page short story encapsulates a story of its own and the story of Sister Ursula. I've kept track. It's 81 and a half pages that she submits total. And when you consider the trickery she resorts to in terms of font size and formatting, it's actually close to 95 pages. again, great job. I was intrigued by the way the gist of that 95-page story was told. Now, if I'm wondering, how real is that story? If I wanted to read it, could you tell it or show it?
I think I've come as close to being able to do that as I ever will. And for the most part, I mean, it's a story told in summary, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Right? Because it's not told in anything like real time. She never stops because she's not a fiction writer. She never stops and really writes a scene in which somebody says something to anybody else. It's all told in summary, and as such, and it's a told story. What they say in workshops, show, don't tell. Sister Ursula always tells.
Well, she does, and I was wondering, the scenes such as at the hospital with her mother just passed away, they beg to be a scene.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So if I wonder, where is that story? Where is that manuscript?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's this whole story, by the way, was once part of my novel Straight Man. Sister Ursula was one of Hank Devereaux's students originally, but her story was so dark. And so heartbreaking, and it took on such a life of its own that when I gave it to my editor, I said, "What do we do with Sister Ursula?" And he says, "Oh, we got to off the nun."
There was a question just down here. There was someone right here. Right, if you want to pass the mic down, please. Thank you. Isn't it amazing what people do with your work? He calculated the pages.
Well, actually, it's a good follow-up because two of my favorite words in the story were venial sins, that she plays with the margins. And it made me think how so much, even your darkest novels, a sense of humor informs them. Tell me if you think there's enough human in contemporary fiction today.
Is there enough humor in contemporary fiction? I sometimes wish there were more, especially in certain writers. We won't talk about them, but I just find it absolutely necessary for my own purposes, because even though I'm optimistic, as I said, which is true, for an optimistic guy, I do go to some pretty dark places at times, and I learned from Huckleberry Finn that if you're going to be an American writer and you're going to deal with violence and ignorance and racism and every kind of hatred imaginable, people aren't going to follow you unless you give them some sort of reason to. And I think humor is that reason to, because humor can also be very wise, and it can also take us to these. I think Sister Ursula's story is almost unbearable without the humor that separates those. And when you go back and the students ask those questions, you know, if we were just reading Sister Ursula's, I couldn't bear to tell that story. It is so dark. But the counterpoint of the students asking her those questions and the counterpoint with the professor's life and his comments in the margins of her page, I can't imagine, would anybody in this audience have wanted to read Sister Ursula's story if it weren't interrupted in that way? I'm sorry? In Ireland, they would. She said, in Ireland, they would.
Good point. So we have to end, unfortunately, because I feel like this discussion could go on forever. But before we do end, I want to ask you just one more question.
Okay.
I'm your closer. I talk to many artists, and I always ask them, what can we learn from you? Frequently, the answer is, learn to be comfortable with failure. As an artist yourself, Richard, what can you tell us for both the writers and the people in the audience who dream of being writers? What can you tell us from your vantage point as an artist to take forth in our own lives?
Boy.
Sorry.
Yeah, thanks. When I was in high school, I used to run cross country. I ran cross country because I wasn't fast enough to run sprints. And I often think that that was an absolutely formative experience for me, because I think it was one of the first times I ever learned anything about myself that didn't harm me in some way. If I was honest about it, that didn't harm. To learn that there were so many other boys that could run so much faster than I could really broke my heart. And it would have put me off of an awful lot of things if I hadn't discovered that they would stop and I would continue. That was the thing that I could do. They would get tired, and I would continue. I can't think of a better prescription, at least for a novelist. I don't know about a short story writer, but short stories are actually, I think, closer in some ways in terms of the experience of getting them out, are closer to lyric poetry. The novel is what you do when you at age 15 run cross country for a Catholic high school.
Great. So we should say thank you to the Boston Book Festival, to Richard. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.